President Obama may have riled Republicans with his recess appointment of Richard Cordray to lead the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, but there's bipartisan agreement on Mr. Cordray's qualifications. He served as Ohio's Attorney General. Before that, he was Ohio State Treasurer. For more, we're joined by our friend from the business world, New York Times op-ed columnist Joe Nocera. Joe, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
Joe, when we spoke in December, the Senate had blocked any confirmation vote for Richard Cordray. You talked about all the things you thought the Bureau couldn't do because they didn't have a director. Well, now they do. What do you expect to see?
Well, I definitely expect them to try and to get their arms around this whole sphere of unregulated financial institutions. We're talking about payday lending. We're talking about debt collecting. We're talking about the companies that rate your credit, the credit scoring companies, which have enormous importance. They affect 200 million people. And you can't buy a house or a car without a decent credit score. This has the potential, by the way, to be enormously popular politically as well.
Mr. Cordray spoke with NPR's All Things Considered earlier this week and said this.
Well, the key for us is that part of our job is to make prices and risks clear for consumers so that they can make good, better-informed judgments for themselves. That doesn't mean that we're prejudging any particular product. We will be regulating payday lenders, mortgage brokers, private student lenders, and that's a very important step forward for us.
Joe, how do you expect the Bureau to enforce this?
Well, I mean, they have staff. They have enforcement staff. What he said at the beginning of that clip is very much what they have been doing so far, trying to simplify forms, trying to allow people, for instance, who are going to get an adjustable rate mortgage, to see what the ultimate cost would be versus a 30-year fixed mortgage, trying to have credit card statements that people can actually understand, very simple consumer-friendly things. As they move forward, they almost certainly will bring an early action against, for instance, a payday lender that is deceiving consumers or a debt collector that is using underhanded tactics. I mean, those are very politically popular things to do, and these are areas that have been unregulated for a very long time.
Let me ask you about the political dimensions of this appointment, because Mr. Cordray, everyone notes, was a five-time undefeated Jeopardy champion. He's also been elected to statewide office in Ohio a couple of times. Ohio's a significant state politically.
Well, I mean, that is true, but I'm not convinced that that's why he got the job.
It was also ground zero for the mortgage crisis.
That's right. And he has a very aggressive track record as Attorney General in Ohio of trying to prosecute mortgage fraud. He got a $725 million settlement out of AIG. You know, he sued GMAC, a General Motors mortgage arm. You know, he's done a lot in this area. And the person who hired him originally was not President Obama. It was Elizabeth Warren to make him her first enforcement chief as she was setting up the Bureau. Now, of course, it became impossible politically to get Elizabeth Warren named, so the president decided to appoint Cordray instead. I think the politics have less to do with Ohio than with the whole idea that we're going to stand up for consumers, we're going to do some aggressive things on behalf of consumers, and we're going to contrast that behavior with what the Republicans are doing, which, as Obama would phrase it, is protecting the banks.
Nevertheless, there are going to be some legal challenges, questioning the constitutionality of the recess appointment, even the powers of the agency. Will that practically limit what the Bureau can do, these present circumstances?
They say no. I say probably. It seems very likely that they will spend a lot of their first year in court defending themselves on five or six or seven different grounds, and that has to be inevitably time-consuming.
So even if Mr. Cordray's appointment is eventually legally upheld, over the next year there's just going to be so much on his plate, the effectiveness of the agency might be diminished.
I think that's possible. I mean, the senators and the Chamber of Commerce and all the opponents of this are going to do their best to muck up the works as much as possible between now and this November.
Joe Nocera, op-ed columnist for the New York Times, speaking with us from Southampton, New York. Joe, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Shakespeare's Iago is one of the great defining villains of literature. He masquerades as a friend, and that disguises his schemes to manipulate, betray, and destroy. He fools Othello into believing that his wife is betraying him. She's not, then manipulates his old friend and commander into having her killed in a fit of engineered jealousy. But when Iago's deceits are discovered and he's imprisoned, he clams up invoking his right to remain silent centuries before the Miranda ruling. "Demand me nothing," he says at the end of Othello. "What you know, you know. From this time forth, I never will speak word." So he doesn't, until now. David Snowden, who worked as a script editor in a famous BBC production of Shakespeare's plays, has now written a novel in which he imagines what happens after Iago was put behind a stout iron prison door in Crete. His new book is called Iago. David Snowden joins us from London. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's good to be with you.
What prompted you to pick up Iago and run with him into a new story?
Well, I've been obsessed with him ever since as a mere boy. I went to the Old Vic Theatre here in London and queued all night and all day to see the great Laurence Olivier do his Othello. But despite his being extraordinary and quite the most remarkable theatrical experience I've ever had, the person who I was drawn most to was Frank Finlay's Iago. And then I won't admit how many years later, I was working here at the BBC on the BBC Shakespeare's, and there was a production that Dr. Jonathan Miller directed with Anthony Hopkins as Othello and Bob Hoskins as Iago. And I have to say, Bob Hoskins' performance as Iago was probably the best performance I've ever seen, and I've seen a lot of them. And it was from that point on that I began to think, well, it would be nice to try and portray this iconic Shakespearean villain as if he was just a man, and to try and find out why he does what he does.
At the heart of your story is a character named Annibale Malipiero, who is the chief inquisitor of the Serene Republic of Venice.
Yeah.
Is this a, as they might put it in Venice, water-weary cop?
How do you mean? I'm sorry.
We would say street-weary cop, but I changed it for Venice.
Canal-weary cop.
Canal-weary, or better, better.
Well, actually, I've made him not only a canal-weary cop, but I've made him a cop who doesn't like water, which I think is, you know, just one of the little jokes I've got in the book.
And the chief inquisitor, he hatches his own scheme, if you please.
Yeah, he does.
A 15-year-old kid, Gentile Stornello, a dreamy boy who's been framed for murder. And he arranges for the two of them to escape from prison together, and they go off on a jaunt, fleeing through the countryside. Now, what does the Inquisitor hope will happen on their romp?
Well, the most important thing to remember about Iago at the end of the play is that he says, from now on, I will speak no more, I will say nothing. And he hasn't spoken, and it is only when he arrives in the prison he starts to speak to the boy, because the boy is, in fact, a cousin of another character in the play, Desdemona, who Iago has manipulated Othello to kill. So somehow that association makes Iago speak. And Annibale, our wily inquisitor, Annibale, thinks, well, if he's speaking to this boy, and he's not speaking to me, and he's not speaking to anybody else, maybe I should use this boy as a means of getting him to talk more and to reveal not that he did it or he didn't do it, but why he did what he did. You know, Iago's no psychopath. He's not a mass murderer. He only kills one person, that's his wife, and he kills her because she's about to spill the beans. He gets other people to hate each other. He's I suppose, what you'd call a sociopath. He's somebody who believes in making people destroy each other. I think that's what fascinates him, and that's what fascinates me about this kind of person.
And when you work with Shakespeare's words in the kind of proximity that you did, when you take some of his characters and storylines and try and run them through your own imagination, how does it change your appreciation for Shakespeare's genius?
Well, one thing I've somewhat contentiously say sometimes about Shakespeare is that he wasn't very good at plots. He's fantastic at creating characters, and of course his verse is matchless, and his prose is matchless. But his plots, most notably the plot of Othello, are not totally watertight. That aside, his characters are devastatingly profound, and one treads very warily on those characters, and some might say that I've been a bit cheeky to have done so, but I certainly want to emphasize that my take on Iago is just my take on Iago, And more importantly than anything, I want people to read it who don't know who Iago was, and who don't know who Othello was, and who don't know, dare I say it, who Shakespeare was. Now, it's unlikely that many of those will, but in some sense, it's a story that I want to stand on its own. I just hope it's a jolly good story.
So what's next? As it turns out, Juliet lives.
Well, you see, this
wakes up and marries a rug salesman.
Yeah, anything's possible. Look, a very, very good friend of mine has told me that I've got a franchise here. I've got Cressida, I've got Juliet, but actually, in truth, believe it or not, I am doing another villain, but it's a woman, and it's very different from Iago. It's in fact Goneril in King Lear, who is the nasty older sister, Cordelia's older sister, Goneril and Regan, often called the ugly sisters of Shakespeare. I just think she's an absolutely fascinating character.
David Snowden, joining us from London, his new novel, and clearly not his last, Iago. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much indeed.
Elizabeth McGovern is back. She was never really gone. She just moved across the pond. She was 19 when a star was born, hers. She played the love interest in Robert Redford's film, Ordinary People, and went on to co-star with some of Hollywood's leading men, including Robert De Niro, Brad Pitt, and Sean Penn. She starred in Milos Forman's big-budget film, Ragtime. But in the early 1990s, Elizabeth McGovern married some British guy. She gave up Hollywood for London. She raised a family and developed a British acting career, and now, after two decades, Elizabeth McGovern is back on American screens. She plays Lady Cora in the wildly popular Emmy Award-winning British series Downton Abbey.
She's a wonderful nurse and she's worked very hard.
But in the process, she's forgotten who she is.
Has she, Robert? Or have we overlooked who she really is?
Elizabeth McGovern joins us from our studios in New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
I'm very happy to be here, too.
Downton Abbey is a period drama, although the whole point of it has contemporary overtones. It's the Edwardian era, follows the lives and loves of the aristocratic Crawley family and their servants, often compared to that signature 1970s series Upstairs, Downstairs. Do you think the fact that you're kind of coming to that from the outside gives you some added insight?
Are you asking the fact that I live in England, does that give me added insight to the character? Is that what your question is?
The fact that you're an American living in England.
Yes, of course it does. I've spent 20 years rehearsing the part. I mean, that might have something to do with why I got it. But I don't think that my experience inculcating myself into English life is that wildly different from Cora, the character I play in Downton Abbey. But I do find myself bumping up against a culture that is in many subtle ways quite different to my own and is a very interesting juxtaposition for me personally and, in this case, professionally.
I'd like you to look after Sir Anthony Strallan tonight. He's a nice, decent man. His position may not be quite like Papa's, but it would still make you a force for good in the county.
Mama, not again. How many times am I to be ordered to marry the man sitting next to me at dinner?
As many times as it takes.
I turned down Matthew Crawley. Is it likely I'd marry Strallan when I wouldn't marry him?
I'm glad you've come to think more highly of Cousin Matthew.
Well, that's not the point.
No.
How do you analyze the fascination audiences have with dramas from this period, and particularly the dramas that depict the aristocratic family and the folks providing for them in all ways who live downstairs?
It's a perfect recipe for a television show because most of the time what makes a television show are different versions of families trapped more or less in one space, and then they knock against one another and that creates stories. The fact that we have a complicated class system in which all these people are completely interdependent on one another, and yet there are these very firm walls that separate them. It's an absolute spark plug for untold number of stories and fascinating historical situations as well.
Let me ask about your cast of players, because it's terrific. I mean, Hugh Bonneville is the Earl of Grantham. Dame Maggie Smith, who you mentioned, as the Dowager Countess, your your mother-in-law, if you please.
Mm-hmm.
Is she as intimidating in person as she seems on screen?
Yeah, she's scary. But she's a lot of fun.
You may not know it, but I believe the committee feel obliged to give you the cup for the best bloom as a kind of local tradition.
No, I do not know that. I thought I usually won the prize for best bloom in the village because my gardener had grown the best bloom in the village.
Yes, but you don't usually win, do you? You always win.
What's it like to play a scene with her?
One is always kept on one's toes with Maggie.
I was right about my maid. She's leaving to get married. Well, how could you be so selfish?
I do sympathize. Robert's always wanting me to get rid of O'Brien, but I can't face it. Anyway, she's so fond of me.
Well, I thought Simmons was fond of me. What am I to do?
She has a very facile, quick brain and is always searching for the chink that has been overlooked. And you have to really keep your wits about you, but I wouldn't have it any other way.
There's a quote. Maybe you didn't expect it to get to this side of the pond, but in the days of the internet, where you say that you think that maybe the British make better films than Americans.
Well, just putting it in context, I was at the British Independent Film Awards, and a microphone was thrust into my face, and I felt I should say the politic thing. Of course, I don't feel that way completely, 100%, of course not.
Your husband's career, the director, is flourishing. Your husband is Simon Curtis.
Simon Curtis is his name, yeah. I'm proud of him. He's directed a movie called My Week with Marilyn, which is the best movie about show business that I've ever seen. And I'm actually not saying that because he's my husband, because I am often critical of his work.
Downton Abbey is continuing in production, right?
Yeah, we're starting season 3 in February.
And I know you can't talk about what happens, but...
But?
Well, without talking specifically about what happens, can you tell us how Lady Cora will react to the world changing around her?
World War I puts a lot of pressure on the Grantham marriage. The world as they knew it, that consistent, solid place that for generations had existed, is threatened deeply. And both of them have very different reactions to this. I think that it's hard for Lady Cora to adjust to this new reality, but it's easier for her than it is for her husband, Robert. And it sort of exposes fissures in their marriage that might otherwise have gone unnoticed. So it does have an effect on their marriage.
The new season of Downton Abbey starts on PBS tomorrow. Elizabeth McGovern joined us from New York. Thanks so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Iowa and New Hampshire are not demographic snapshots of America. They're smaller, less diverse, and more rural than California, New York, or Illinois, which have a lot more votes. But Iowa and New Hampshire win a lot of attention early in an election year. As an old political columnist, now departed, once told me over the din of clinking cups in an Iowa diner, if the first presidential caucuses were in Hawaii, Congress would give federal subsidies to make gasoline out of pineapples. But as all the effort to please a few thousand voters in Iowa and New Hampshire makes sense. Both major parties have fiddled with the primary lineup in recent years. Iowa and New Hampshire vow to remain first, even if they have to reschedule their voting for Halloween. The parties moved South Carolina and Florida to earlier primary dates at the end of this month to give more weight to the growing South. South Carolina has an African-American population of almost 30%. The demographic data for Florida, numbers of blacks, whites, Hispanics, Asians, even average daily commuting time, are within just a few percentage points of the national census numbers. Florida is also now the fourth most populous state in the nation, which often astonishes New Yorkers. But I'm always inspired to see the road to the White House begin in two small, snowy states in which anyone who wants to look a candidate in the eye probably can, up close. Presidential contenders in Iowa and New Hampshire aren't just images on a screen. They're as eager to shake your hand as a friendly dog is to lick your shoes. People in town halls tend to ask informed questions about trade, jobs, debt, and security, not just about opinion polls or who's the Minister for Construction and Spatial Planning of Croatia. Iowa and New Hampshire let candidates with less money for ads at least try to compete with hard work, hearty handshakes, and ideas. There's a long list of people who won caucuses or primaries in those states who were not elected president. Mike Huckabee, Dick Gephardt, Hillary Clinton, Henry Cabot Lodge, and Paul Tsongas. But some years you can see the hand of history. Jimmy Carter won Iowa, then New Hampshire, in 1976, and was no longer just a grinning, long-shot Southern governor. Barack Obama's victory in Iowa's 2008 caucuses seemed to answer if an African-American junior senator from a big city could win the votes and hopes of whites in small-town America with Yes, We Can. Iowa and New Hampshire might look small and vanilla in a nation of multiplying hues and creeds, but they pay attention to their leadoff role. And you're listening to NPR News.